Welcome to Shooks and Gifts, Season 7, Episode 4, Responsible Use of AI in the Classroom with Eric Kurtz. In this episode, I talk to Eric Kurtz about his take on AI in education, including the benefits, concerns, bias, and more. Let's give it a go. Welcome to Shooks and Gifts, the podcast where I share edtech treasures I love. Each episode, I share a tool, website, tip, trick, or more that you might find helpful for you or your learners. I'm your host, Jen Giffen. Let's give it a go. So I had a student come into the Library Learning Commons this week asking me if we had this book about Pavlov's dog. And I said, you know, it rings a bell. Hello, everyone, and welcome to season seven. That's a new number. Season seven, episode four of Shooks and Gif. I am joined today by a friend of the show, friend of mine. I don't think I've had an episode that I haven't mentioned his name, Mr. Eric Kurtz. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, thank you so very much for having me. I'm so happy to be here with you today.
Eric, for those who don't know you, and I'm not totally sure how you can be in education, particularly not a Shooks and Gifts listener, and not know who you are, why don't you tell people a little bit about who you are, where you're from, and what you do?
Absolutely. So my name's Eric Kurtz. I'm an educator in Northeast Ohio. This is actually my 32nd year in education, so I've been doing this a long time. I was a middle school math teacher at first, taught for 7 years, and then switched into a role as a tech coach or a tech integration specialist, whatever you want to call it. Basically went from teaching kids to teaching teachers, and that's what I do. I currently work at a regional service center where we support about 35 school districts up in Northeast Ohio. And then on the side, I do my own consulting, traveling around the country, working with schools, conferences, organizations. A lot of training in the past on googly things. That's where I've done a lot of my work. Most recently, AI. The last year, I would say 95% of any sessions I'm doing, it's all, you know, about AI. That has become the main focus as far as that goes. I run a website called Control Alt Achieve, where you can find all my stuff. That's kind of the hub where everything's at. So that's a quick overview of who I am.
And you are such a good sharer. Honestly, if you've never been to Eric's website, you need to go. He has everything there, like anything you ever need to find, certainly about googly stuff. And now, like he said about AI, is there ready for you to peruse. Videos are in there. Like it's a fabulous, fabulous resource. So Eric, thank you for taking the time to do that.
Well, no, and I'm glad it's valuable. And, you know, my philosophy is about sharing. It really is. And, you know, I encourage people to do that because, you know, anything I create, it's not like, oh, I created that. No, I got inspired by somebody else. I learned from somebody else. I saw this cool thing. This is my iteration of it, my twist on it. I want you to make your twist on it. So everything I put out, I release under a Creative Commons license that you can modify, adapt, reuse. All I ask is leave a link back to where you got it. But please use these things, build upon them, and continue to share them out.
We need more of that. We need more of that in education. Okay, let's go to how you got here today. So in my last, well, in the last season, near the end of season six, and then at the beginning of season seven, I was sharing a whole bunch of AI tools because like Eric said, that's basically where we're living now. This is where education is what we're seeing a lot of. This is like all the buzz in the good ways and, you know, for some people, the apprehensive ways. And I had a moment where I said in episode two, you know, I just feel like maybe I'm losing my creativity. Am I not thinking? And that's when Tom Mullaney reached out to me and said, Jen, that made an impact on me. Would you be willing to have me on and talk about AI from the perspective of apprehensions we had? I said, yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, if you missed it in the last episode, that's what Tom and I talked about. It was a really interesting conversation, gave me a lot of pause, moments of thought, but I didn't want to only present one side of that discussion, right? I've been presenting almost, I don't want to use the word recklessly because I think that's a little bit extreme, but I certainly was just presenting tools and making the assumption that people were going to do that pause and reflect and not dive in. And the more I felt this dissonance within myself around maybe, you know, should I be using it this way? Should I not? I was like, I wonder if everyone is feeling that way. So maybe I need to have some people on who know more about this. So, you know, I invited Tom on to talk about the side of apprehension. And then I thought, well, who else can I talk to about why this, how we can use this for good and how we can use this responsibly in education. And I know, Eric, you've been doing, like you said, a lot of work there. Eric and I chatted and I said, you know, how about you come on, would you do that? And he said, yeah, absolutely. So I didn't want to present a single side or a single narrative of this talk, which is why Eric is here today. I'm sure there's a lot of people that will align their views with, you know, what Tom had to say last episode, a lot will align with what Eric, I'm sure, will share this episode, and a lot will fall in the middle. And I just want to keep that conversation going so that at the end of the day, the responsible use and where we feel we're responsible, where our districts feel responsible, where the parents of our students themselves feel comfortable, all of that is being explored. So with that said, Eric, why don't you start by just telling folks who may not know, what is it that you've been doing in AI, either concrete examples or just like philosophically things that you've been discussing?
Yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to what I've been presenting with AI, most of the time we've got schools that are very early on in this. And so my typical session is what I call the ABCs of AI, where I cover three things. The A is all about AI. So what is AI and what are the tools that are currently out there? The B is the benefits of AI. How can we use it in practical ways in our classrooms to support teachers and students for teaching and learning? And the C is the concerns of AI. What are the things, the potential misuses, the things we need to be aware of, whether it's biases, inaccuracies, academic integrity, cheating, effects on creativity and critical thinking, data privacy, all those sort of things. And so I try to hit the whole gamut. And many times that's like a 3-hour workshop, sometimes more, sometimes less, depending. So that's a very common thing that I present. But then within that, I'm starting to then, you know, break out some specific things. I'll do just a session on a portion of this. And one of the things that I do a session on is using AI as a classroom guest. I guess that's the phrase to describe it. That's actually, I think, the name of my session, having AI as a special classroom guest. I will point people to that resource if they want to look at it a little closer. All of my resources are always a bit.ly link. They follow the same format. It's bit.ly/Kurtz-something. And that something is whatever that particular topic is. So if people want to take a look at that, what I'm going to be chatting about here, it's bit.ly/Kurtz-AI guest. That would take you to that particular one that we're talking about. If you just do bit.ly/Kurtz-AI, then that's my big ABCs of AI session. But if you do -AI guest, you can look at this particular one. And basically the idea is having AI interact with the students in your class as if it was something else, as if it was fulfilling a role. And this can take on a lot of forms. This can be a lot of things. It can be that you're having it pretend to be a person. You know, one of the examples, you know, I would give is having it be a historical figure. But sometimes it's having it be a character from the book you're reading. Sometimes having the AI be somebody from a different place, a different time, maybe not even a person, having the AI be an animal, having the AI be an object. Had a teacher who had the AI pretend to be an earthquake, and the students were learning about earthquakes. So they interviewed an earthquake, you know? So that's one approach, is to say, okay, have the AI be something and then the students, you know, interview it. But other ones I've done in this project is the AI debate. You basically say, hey, here is a topic that we want to have a debate on. And we tell the AI, this is your side. And then the class picks the other side and you have a debate back and forth. And this is fascinating because sometimes one thing we worry about is, you know, oh boy, once, you know, with AI, are we going to have critical thinking like we've had in the past? Is AI just going to do everything for us? Well, I don't view it that way. I think AI is just a tool. It's not good. It's not bad. It's just like a hammer. You can build with it. You can destroy with it. Same thing here. Yeah, you could just use AI and not think for yourself, or an activity like the AI debate. It raises critical thinking. It's an amazing thing because I've done it. For what it's worth, I tried it out. I said the topic was going to be, what is the correct way to pronounce the word GIF? And I told the AI that it would go with a soft G, GIF, and I would go with
and
the
hard G. And that's the end
G,
of the podcast GIF. Today, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. thank you, Eric.
So, and we had a half an hour debate back and forth on the correct way to pronounce the word spelled GIF. It made me think on levels I had never thought that deep. You know, and so it can do critical thinking, it can raise critical thinking, you know, and then you can do AI games, you can play 20 questions with it, you can do AI co-writing, where the AI writes one paragraph, then the students write the next paragraph. So this whole AI guest thing, it's not just interviewing a historical figure, it's having a conversation with the AI where you've given it a role. So you can do this with ChatGPT, you can do this with Gemini, you can do this with Copilot or Claude or any of those, but you as the teacher are giving it a prescribed role. You're giving it some boundaries within which to operate. Or if you don't want to use one of those tools, there's fantastic ones out there that are built on top of things like ChatGPT. There's School AI, not Magic School AI. It's wonderful. I love that too. But School AI. And then there's one called Mizu. And these basically do the same thing. They help build a custom chatbot that has parameters, has guardrails, it has a purpose, and then the students are interacting with it within those. So that in general is that activity. I've presented this bunches and bunches of times, and it is definitely a high interest activity. This is one that is very easy to do tomorrow with your students, you know, type of a thing. You know, it's an easy activity to do that can be very engaging for our students, can really get them thinking critically. And I think having that conversational aspect of it is something that can increase the motivation and the engagement. Now, having said that, I don't recommend that you just do this. You don't just be like, hey, I heard about this really fun idea. Hey, kids, let's try this out. And so live in front of the class, you're like, okay, I'm going to log into ChatGPT. Hey, kids, what should we have the AI be? Okay, let's have you be George Washington. What do you want to ask it, guys? And just doing that live. Because think about an analogy here. What if you had a guest speaker coming into your classroom, a physical person coming into your classroom? Wouldn't you do some vetting ahead of time? Wouldn't you try to find out this person actually does know what they're speaking about? And wouldn't you ask them some questions beforehand? Or if you're going to show a movie to your students, would you ever just pop it in and hit play? Or would you have watched that movie ahead of time? Or you get the idea. You know, we need to apply the same rigor to AI tools as we already do in education to our other tools. So when I present this, and if somebody eventually does go into that document, bit.ly/Kurtz-AI guest, they'll see.
I have in the show notes for people who are looking for it as well.
Wonderful. Let you know. Perfect. Once you get in there, there's a whole section you will see on like page 4 and 5 and 6, where it talks about proper preparation for this type of an activity. So for example, in there, one thing I mention is before the activity. I say, as always with any AI activity, make sure that it properly aligns with the guidelines of your school. You know, if you know, make sure you're staying within the proper AI guidelines and policies of your school. And then I go on to say, always test the activity before doing this live with your students to evaluate the AI chatbot that you're going to be using for any possible issues with accuracy or bias. And that's easy to do. I mean, you can provide it the prompt and then you can just start peppering it with questions. You can put in questions that might be the sort of questions a student would ask. And you can do this with ChatGPT, with Gemini, you can do this with Mizu, you can do this with School AI. They all have a preview option where you can try it out ahead of time. If you do find responses that you go, huh, that's not what I want. That's not appropriate for whatever reason. Well, then maybe you try a different chatbot. Maybe you try a different prompt. Maybe you realize you haven't given it the proper boundaries. Or maybe you say, for this particular activity, an AI chatbot's not the right way to go. And you just don't do it, you know, if that's what you end up evaluating it as. But it's important that we do that process ahead of time. Now, is it going to be, is there no chance that something may still go wrong? No, absolutely not. AIs do generate content uniquely each time that you have a conversation with it. So it is certainly possible. But you know what? The same thing is true if I have a guest speaker come into my classroom. It's possible they could go off on a tangent I wasn't expecting. So before the activity, that's your due diligence. During the activity, we still need to stay engaged in that. So when it comes time to actually do the activity, I think it's important, since we are using an AI chatbot, to of course emphasize that, especially with younger students, that we're not actually interviewing George Washington. You know, we are interviewing an AI representation of him, and maybe even use different words. Maybe don't say, hey, what question do you have for George Washington? Maybe say, what question do you have for George Bot, or something like that. It's okay to, you know, emphasize this is an AI, you know, so that, you know, younger students, of course, are, you know, are realizing that. But then so during the actual,
go ahead. Yeah. On that idea then, Eric, do you think that we have a responsibility as educators when we start using AI in our classroom? Is the first thing we do with our students then talking about what AI is, what is a large language model, what are chatbots, how do we see it? And like, you know, you talk about your ABCs. Is it beneficial to do that sort of talk with our kids beforehand? Because we know, like in high school, like I'm a high school teacher, the kids are like totally diving in and going.
Right.
And for me, I'm seeing that. Do you really understand this? And I don't know, what are your thoughts on that?
No, I totally agree. So in that section in the document, one of the bullet points I have in there, it says at the start of the activity, it says, explain to your students that the AI will attempt to provide the best answer possible by pulling from the information it has access to, but will be limited to the data it's been trained on and will only include information that was available up to its latest training date. And it's important that they know that. In the ABCs of AI session I do, in the C, the concerns, one of the bullet points in there is educating students. It's about educating them about what AI is and what it isn't, how it works. Just did a blog post on Control-Alt-Achieve the other day where I listed 8 or 9 great resources to teach students about AI. So it's things like Common Sense Media, code.org, Day of AI. There's one from MIT. There's one from Google. All of these different pre-made curriculums that we can adapt and use in our class to teach students about AI. Absolutely. That's very important that we aren't just, you know, again, rolling this out to them. We are also educating them every step along the way there. And then when the actual activity takes place, it's important that we and our class continue to evaluate the responses that we're getting from the AI, that we're using critical thinking like we would apply to anything, you know, any speaker or any book or movie or any information we come across, looking for potential inaccuracies or biases or so forth. And, you know, asking questions if, like, you know, something doesn't seem to be correct, using that as a teachable moment there, whether it's you as a teacher interjecting and correcting something or asking, well, why do you think the AI said that? There was a podcast, I don't think it's on anymore, but it was called Tell Me Something I Don't Know. And they'd have some guests on and their job was to tell the host something, you know, interesting that they may not be aware of. And they always had a fact checker on the podcast. It would be some special guest each episode, and their job was basically to fact check everything that was being said. Well, I love that model. I love that idea that, yes, we should be fact-checking everything all the time, and encouraging our students to do that as well. So I would encourage folks, if they want to, you know, try this activity, go through these other steps as well. Don't just pop this out in front of your students, but do your proper training, make sure you're letting the students know how this is going to work. And be sure that when you're doing the activity, that you're looking for potential errors or biases or things like that during it. But having said that, anytime I have done this, it has been, like I said, a high engagement, high interest type of an activity. And many times creating great conversation and raising some, you know, some good critical thinking skills.
Okay. I think it sounds really exciting. I've seen your posts on it. I've played with it myself, and I think you're right. It can be an activity that we do with students, and I love that what you're bringing to the forefront is the idea of, you know, we don't just bring a guest speaker and we don't just have a movie that we play and be like, oh, I didn't realize it was full of, you know, violence or nudity.
Yeah, right.
Or you know, whatever, like we don't do that responsibly. So keeping ourselves in check too, and not sliding down the slippery slope of, oh, hey, this is fun and this can work, and, you know, really testing it. I think even in collaboration, like get a group of teach together. And so there's, you know, the smartest person in the room is the room itself kind of adage or analogy fits in there too. Okay. So then what about the talk that's around bias and inaccuracies in AI? Because that's another thing. That's the pushback. And maybe you want to speak more to the pushback that you've received, because I've done a little bit of like workshops. I'm doing a series called AI for Educators in my school. I just send out like a PDF, really, really simple. Just like, hey, here's a tool that might help you. And I was really reticent to put it out, because I know that I have teachers in my building who are very much like, shut AI down. We cannot be using this. This is bad. If we don't use it, it will go away. I necessarily agree with that. But how do you respond to the naysayers, to the ones that talk about, oh, it's full of bias and there's all these inaccuracies, and what are we doing and why are we trusting the robots? How could someone who is on board with AI respond to that? And well, I guess they can do their own research, obviously, but maybe part of the research is they're listening to you. What have you found to be able to address those concerns?
So I guess bias is a good one to start with, certainly. So where to begin with this? I guess there's a lot of ways we could go on this. Let me start with just a fundamental discussion about the concept of bias. And that is, yes, a lot of times we attach a negative connotation to it, understandably so, because what we don't want is we don't want bias that marginalizes people. We don't want bias that improperly represents somebody. We don't want bias that harms people. But the word bias, the idea of bias, it's just a reality. We are all biased. Everybody is biased. Everything is biased. I am biased. Now, I'm a white dude who grew up in Ohio most of my life. You know, I have, you know, if you compared me to an AI training, you know, data, an AI training large language model, the data I've been fed that I've been fed to build who I am has come from my perspective of a white dude growing up in Ohio. So I have biases, whether I like it or not. There's things I don't know. There's experiences I've not had. There's perspectives I cannot see from well because I didn't live that. Now, my job as a human, as a responsible human, is to try to learn better so I can be better. I want to learn more. I want to broaden my understanding. I want to try to see from other perspectives. So I try every day, you know, to do that. But I would be fooling myself to think for a moment that I will not go to my grave with biases. We all have them. That's just the reality. Now, it's not just that people have biases. All information is biased. You know, if you run a Google search and you get, you know, results on there, yeah, everyone is coming from somebody's perspective. If you read a book, if you watch a movie, if I watched a movie about George Washington, it's going to be filled with biases of the people who wrote that screenplay and who filled in, you know, things to flesh it out. If I read a primary source document, the primary source document is biased because that person was writing from their perspective. The point is, if you said we just need to, you can't use something if it's biased, you can't use anything. You can't use anything. Everything has to be completely thrown out. What we need to say is we need to recognize bias and we need to be able to learn how to intelligently process it. And if something is overly biased and is harmful in the things that it is stating, then we need to realize that and say, okay, that is not going to be appropriate for this age group for this particular thing, although it might be appropriate for a different age group where we're intentionally discussing what that bias is. So what I'm saying is I am never of the opinion to just say, let's just not do it. Let's just throw it out. Let's just, you know, it's like the throwing out the baby with the bathwater approach. Instead, I feel our responsibility as educators, and especially as ed tech coaches, is to show how do you do these activities appropriately? How do you address the biases? Because they're going to be there no matter what it is. And that is critical thinking. That is the skills that we're trying to develop in our students. Now, that brings us to the question, so what about AI? How is it biased and how biased is it and so forth? So
and how do we know when it's biased? Like what so, when I see it, sure. If I don't know what I don't know, how, and that's my challenge I find that I have when I use it. I'm like, okay, is this bias? And but I suppose that's with any resource I use, not just
sure
AI.
Sure.
The thing with other resources, I can usually go back to the root source.
So good point. I think AI is so new that it does help that we pause for a moment and think about, well, how is it even built? Now, I think most people are getting more comfortable with this now, but a large language model, the classic large language model, let's take, you know, ChatGPT, you know, 3, 3.5, things like that. By the time we get to 4 and Gemini and some of these, not quite exactly the same, but the classic large language model is you feed it everything. You give it every book ever written, you give it every web page it can crawl, you give it every picture that's available, you feed it every bit of information you can possibly feed it. And then what it does is it takes all of that information to draw from when a question is asked of it. Now, because it's doing that, because it is being fed all the information, all the blog posts, all the books that have been written, it's going to be inherently biased because we are biased. It's eating our information. It has all the biases that a human has because we've fed it everything a human has ever written. So here's the thing. When somebody hears that, there could be a quick reaction to say, well, then we can't trust it. Well, the story doesn't end there. These companies, they don't want to be sued. They don't want to lose money. They don't want to make people mad. They want to have a successful product. So you know what? When you use ChatGPT or Gemini or something like that, guess what? You're not getting the raw model. They are actively addressing the biases that are in there. When they first train a model, yeah, if you asked it questions, you're going to probably get answers that are mostly from a white male perspective. Why? Because we've produced a lot of stuff. You know, there's a lot of content out there to draw from. So what these companies do is they intentionally go in and they adjust the you know, the switches, they adjust the levels. They try to account for biases. They hire people to represent a wide range of perspectives, and their job is to sit there and just interact with it and take note of where there are problems and let the company know. And then the company redials things to try to counteract that bias. A good example that many people might see as a negative, I see it as a positive. Just in the news last week, Google got, you know, a lot of bad flack for their AI image generation in Gemini. What was happening is people were going in and saying, give me a picture of, you know, somebody landing at Plymouth Rock, you know, a pilgrim landing, or give me a picture of somebody fighting in, you know, a particular war or something. And the images coming back were not racially accurate for that historical scene. You know, it would be putting somebody of either a gender or a race that, like, wait, no, that actually would not have been. You would not have had somebody of that race in that particular historical scene. And what had happened was they had overcompensated for bias. Here's why. Let's say you go in and you say, draw me a picture, create a picture of a successful CEO. Would you be upset if you got back four images of old white dudes? Yeah. I mean, if that's all it created, that would be a problem. What if you said, generate a picture of a nurse? What if it was just a bunch of women, if that's all that came back? Wouldn't that be a problem? So what Google did is they intentionally went in and adjusted for bias and said, no, we need good representation. Well, they went too far. And so now when you asked for a picture that was to be a specific historical time, you were still getting this better representation. And they said, okay, we made a mistake. You wanted something that was specific for that time. In that case, okay, that should be a white dude there, you know? And here's the point. These companies, they're actively working to address bias. Is there still going to be bias? Yes, but it's not this nefarious thing. It's not this unchecked, running rampant thing. It is something that they are working very diligently to try to improve. Is it perfect? No, it's not. We have to be aware of it. We will always have to use critical thinking no matter what. But I don't want people to get this feeling like it's this boogeyman out there that, you know, these AI companies are, you know, trying to amplify biases. The opposite. They're trying to not amplify biases. They're trying to provide proper representation. So I'm encouraged by that. Is there work to be done? Yes. Do we need to get better? Absolutely. But that's what we're trying to do. That's what they're working on. So when it comes to the whole bias issue, my response is everybody's got it. It's going to be everywhere. We got to deal with it responsibly. And I don't want people to put AI in a special category where it is, you know, less trustworthy than other forms of media. I think it deserves, you know, as much of a use as any other form of media, but also deserves the same scrutiny. But people are working hard to address those biases that may be in the system, because the system's built on us. It's built on us. And so we're trying to work against our own biases that are in there.
Okay. I have a thought as you're talking about this, and I don't know if I'm going to land it properly without it sounding muddled, but do you think that there would be an AI ever where you could almost filter the voices that were the ideas that were feeding into the AI? So I could go in and say, I only want to hear about this from the perspective of Canadian women like me.
Absolutely.
Yes. Do you think it's already there?
So, short answer is no, we're not there yet, but without a doubt, this is going to happen for good and for bad. This is going to happen. Mm-hmm. Right now, the major large language models, ChatGPT, Gemini, Anthropic's Claude, Mistral, all of these, they are as vanilla as you can get. You know, they are shooting for non-biased, most representative as they can possibly be, non-offensive thing. That's what everybody's trying to create. It's not going to stay there, I guarantee you, especially because take a company like Meta. They open source a lot of their large language models, Llama and all of these different ones that people can take and build off of. So I know somebody's already doing it, but as far as widespread use, where we're going to head, sure, there's going to be an AI that is as, you know, right-wing as possible. There's going to be an AI that's as woke as possible. There's going to be an AI that is as, you know, female as possible, or whatever the case might be. And I know those are, you know, overgeneralizations there, but yes, that's going to happen. Somebody's going to say, well, I want my AI to come from a certain perspective. Now, I can already go in and I can prompt an AI to some degree and say, play the role of from this perspective, XYZ. But will there be large language models that at their core have been trained a certain way? Oh, absolutely. It's going to happen. And I do worry about that. I think that's just another layer of potential bias we need to be aware of. And I hope the thing is that people will be transparent about it. They'll be like, hey, if you want an AI that comes from this point of view, now think about it. I mean, you know, if China creates, you know, an AI, and you ask it about, you know, some of the atrocities that have occurred in the past, you know, will the AI give different answers, you know, than it would if it was an AI created somewhere else? Yes, this will happen. Yeah, absolutely.
So how can we be responsible then to know where it's coming from? Like, I dive in. Is there a way that I can go back and say, okay, how was Gemini trained? How was Copilot trained? How was they revealing that?
To a degree, no. Part of it is these companies are protecting their trade secrets, you know, as far as how things were trained. OpenAI used to be way more open. They used to be a lot more open about. So version 3.0 was much more open. By now, where they're at with 4, no, they did not reveal the training weights. They did not reveal, you know, the exact sources where things came from. So that's going to become a lot harder to do because they are trying to protect their trade secrets. Where do I fall down on this? I would say, for me, it's a matter of trying. I try out a lot of different tools and I evaluate them for the responses I get. I use ChatGPT, I use Microsoft Copilot, I use Gemini, I use Claude, I use Mistral, I use Perplexity, I use Pi. I use all of these tools. And I think it's helpful to try more than one tool. And I say in general, I feel more comfortable going with some of the, you know, leading tools because there's more scrutiny on them. More people are watching them. You know, a smaller one that isn't being as many eyes on as others, you know, might not be as well scrutinized. And so I probably lean more towards some of the bigger ones. Yeah.
Okay.
Now besides bias, go ahead. I was going to say besides bias. I know inaccuracy was another concern, just like things being wrong, you know, in an AI model. And so I do get that too, that yes, AI models can make mistakes. Sometimes we call them hallucinations, you know, things like that. They can make mistakes. I guess
sometimes I make mistakes when I'm hallucinating as well.
Yeah, exactly. I guess what I would say there, you know, to some degree, it's applying the same things. You know, we need to use critical thinking and we need to realize that there can be mistakes in any, you know, there's mistakes in books, there's mistakes in, you know, people. If I, you know, what the example I typically give is when I'm doing this in a training, I'll have 100 people in the room or something, and I'll say, okay, I just asked this AI to explain how a biological virus works, you know, and it just gave us an explanation. If I asked all 100 of you that, might we get some mistakes? Yes, we probably would. So if I asked it 100 times, might one of those responses not have everything perfect? Maybe. Well, so what do we do about that? A couple of things. You know, one is some of the AI tools are starting to be very proactive about this. I love how Gemini has built into it a double check button. At the bottom of every response, there's a Google logo. And if you hover above it, it says double check response. If you click if you click that, and this is in the free version, this is, you know, anybody can do this. If you click that at the bottom of the Gemini response, what it does is it will Google the entire response line by line, and it goes out to find, can it verify this information? What it then does is it color codes it. It turns it green if it could find reputable sites that verify that information. It turns words orange-ish if it cannot find good information or if it finds contradictory information. And it's not just color coding. Every one of those is now a live hyperlink. You can click on the sentence and it pulls up the website that it referenced. You click that, it takes you to the website where in purple it highlights the information that was that verifies that. That is a wonderful tool that's just built into Gemini. And it's been there since it was Bard. That's been there from like day one. It's a fantastic tool.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. And that's one that I teach when I
talk about. See, I haven't played a lot with Gemini.
Sure.
Yeah. And that's, I haven't played with it because it only came to Canada in the last month.
I understand. I totally understand. I am hoping more AI models will adopt that type of an approach. Now, Copilot from Microsoft does a decent job. It does a lot of footnote references at the bottom, which is good. I appreciate that. ChatGPT at the moment really doesn't do this. I wish they would. I hope they will put in like a double check button, because I think Google's doing a fantastic thing by doing that. So that's good. Another thing is, keep in mind, when it comes to inaccuracies, sometimes the concern is, well, the information's outdated. You know, this model was, you know, trained up to a certain point, and now I'm not getting accurate modern information. Unfortunately, that belief, that's just not true anymore. That's how AIs started. That's not really how they are anymore. If you use Gemini, even when you use Bard, It has always been able to search the web. It has access to live information. The free version of Gemini does that. Microsoft Copilot, the free version, can browse the web. Perplexity. If you haven't used Perplexity, that is what it does. When you go to Perplexity and you type in a question for it, it literally does a Google search and it pulls up, you know, the top 20, 30 results. It reads every single one of them, and then it synthesizes the information for you. It's doing what you would be doing yourself if you went out and read the top, you know, whatever 10, 20, 30 results there. So the modern AI tools are not just on a data set that stopped in 2001 or something. They are accessing live, relevant, accurate information there. And it's getting better and better and better all the time. So I don't want to in any way discount these concerns. I want to address them, because my concern is somebody looks at it and goes, it can make mistakes, it can be biased, shut it down. I don't think that's responsible. I think it can be biased, it can make mistakes, but they are actively working to address those things. And here are ways we can do better about it. And my job is to help teach those literacy skills and to say, this is a valuable resource. It is valuable. I consider myself a realist. I see the negatives, I see the positives, but I'm trying to push the needle toward how can we use it to transform education? How can we use it to personalize learning for each student? That is something that I think is the revolution when we talk about how AI could revolutionize education. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about here. It's not that it replaces a teacher ever. That is not what I am saying here. I do a whole keynote called The Bionic Educator, and that's the entire point of it, is that it's the best of a teacher and the best of the technology coming together and the best of the learner and the best of the technology coming together. The idea is I'm one teacher with 125 students. I've always wanted to be able to give personalized feedback and support for every student, but I am limited. There's only so much of me to go around. What if I had a teaching assistant, a TA in the form of an AI that could give personalized feedback to each student and then summarize that information and bring it back to me so I can see who I now need to intervene with personally and do additional help with? That's the sort of thing that we've been hoping for decades. Sal Khan has a wonderful video where he talks about the two sigma problem. And if you haven't seen it, I encourage people to take a look at it. The idea was back when Benjamin Bloom was doing all of his study and all of his work, he basically said, you know, if you take all of the scores of a classroom where you just a standard classroom, you know, you get the bell curve. But what if we want to move that, you know, that bell curve up? What if we want to increase students' achievement? And he said, if you do mastery learning, that was a big thing he was pushing. He said, with mastery learning, you can move students one standard deviation up. You can move their scores one standard deviation up. He said, there is something a little better, but unfortunately, it's unrealistic. You can move students' achievement two standard deviations up, two sigmas up, if you give them a personal tutor. But we can't do that. We can't afford that. There's no way that's going to happen. So let's just work on mastery learning. Well, guess what? We're now approaching that. We're now coming to the spot where every student can have a personal tutor and every teacher can have a personal assistant. And it's not replacing anybody, it's augmenting. And that's where we're going to start seeing the revolution in education in being able to personalize things better to students. Now, there's a lot of concerns. That's why the ABCs has the C. That's why there's the concerns. I do not for a moment want to stand here and make it sound like this is just this panacea that's perfect. No, we have to address academic integrity and the biases and the inaccuracies and concerns about creativity and critical thinking and equitable access and data privacy. And yes, we have to address those things. But my hope is that we do that, and I keep pushing the needle toward, and here's the amazing things we can do with this. This is here, how it can help.
I love that. I think you've given the other side of the coin of this debate about why it's important that we don't just shut it down. You know, people will equate it to book banning, right? If we just ban tools outright, particularly this Absolutely. Kind of tool, right? Hopefully people today have been able to give some thought to what we discussed last episode and what we've discussed this episode and really think about where your comfort level lies. What more work do you need to do in your own practice? What learning do you need to do? Because I think this is part of the fear. We weren't trained on this ourselves, and a lot of teachers like to be holders of the knowledge so that, you know, we can anticipate the problems and the questions. We don't want to let kids down. It comes from a good place in most cases. And I think it's that fear, like, well, we don't know this, so how can I teach it? I think there's also the, well, I know this enough about it, and I'm concerned. Like, my husband talks about AI and deep fakes and where that's going, and I'm not going to open that can of worms with you here today because that's a big one.
That's one of the things I talk about in the C as well. We talk about impersonating people. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, right. So thank you for coming on. Do you have anything as we wrap up today that you want to leave listeners with?
So, yeah, I think the last thing I'll mention is just very briefly, just quickly touch on the ELISA effect, just to wrap this all up. The ELISA effect is a term that's mentioned that basically means that humans tend to imbue human characteristics to artificial text generation tools. But we do this to everything. I mean, humans, I mean, I talk to my dog, I talk to my car, I talk to lots of things. I mean, we do this as humans. So the ELISA effect, again, I don't see this as a positive or a negative. It's just a thing. It's like gravity. It exists. We do this. We imbue human characteristics to other things. If the AI is overly biased to a point that it is harmful, if the AI is inaccurate so much that it is just pouring out false information, then coupling that with the ELISA effect, I understand that would be a concern because now maybe you're going to imbue trust into something that is fatally biased and inaccurate. If that was the case, I disagree. I don't believe that the AI is fatally biased and inaccurate. Instead, I see the ELISA effect as a positive thing because what it means is less friction between the learner and the learning. You know, when I first started doing computer work, you know, when I was, you know, a teenager, I was typing commands, you know, in MS-DOS at a prompt, you know, these cryptic commands to interact with a computer. And then we got a graphic interface where we're dragging things around. Then we got touch screens. And now we're just speaking. And students are going to be doing this their whole life. They're going to be speaking to, you know, whether it's, you know, Siri or Alexa or whatever, they're going to be interacting with these things. Why? Because it's easier for us to do so. We're able to do it more effectively and on a deeper level. And it's important that we use the safe, controlled environment of a school to teach them how to do this properly. This is the place where we train them how to speak to an AI, to understand what it is and what it isn't, and how to use it effectively. And I think, again, the ELISA effect in this case, it's a positive because it allows a young student, an older student, allows anybody to be able to, with less friction, be able to communicate their ideas and then get help back in a way that's natural and works well for us. So there you go.
That's great. Thank you for your time today, Eric. Where can people find you if they want to, you know, get some of your training, if they want to debate you on the ideas you shared here, if they just want to send you a thank you for all the resources you share, where can they reach you?
Well, sure thing. So controlaltachieve.com is my blog. That is the hub of all things. If you go there, there is a tab at the top that says connect on the far right. That has every possible way you can connect with me. So whether it's social media, I've got a Facebook group, I've got an email discussion group, I've got a YouTube channel, I've got an email newsletter. All of that is on the connect tab on controlaltachieve.com. So you can find the way that works best for you to connect. And I encourage people to connect. I appreciate the questions that are being asked around this topic. These are good questions. I appreciate healthy, respectful dialogue and on these topics because I think it is so valuable that we do that so we can move these things forward and keep them positive. So please, yes, do reach out. I am a better person today because of the questions that were asked. My document about having an AI as a guest has more details in it and more directions in it because I was properly challenged on these topics. And I appreciate that.
That's great. And I appreciate you and the time that you spent here with us today. So everyone listening, like always, if Eric shared something today that gave you that aha, I do encourage you to give a go. See you next time. Bye-bye. That's it for this episode of Shooks and GIF. The show notes for this episode and all episodes can be found at www.shooksandgif.com. That's SHUKESANDGIFF. And I'd love to hear about your ahas. Please reach out, DM me on social media. I can be found at Virtual GIF. That's with two Fs. So until next time, if you have an aha, give it a go.